Today is Wednesday, December 16th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Western countries are rolling out COVID-19 vaccines, but what about the rest of the world?
Their governments don't represent an attractive customer to pharmaceutical corporations that are looking to make money off of COVID-19 vaccines.
Also ahead, the U.S. may have its first openly gay cabinet secretary.
This is breaking down a barrier that has existed forever.
Plus, Facebook accuses the French military of spreading misinformation online in Africa. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where after weeks of silence, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has congratulated President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris on their election win. McConnell's message followed Monday's formal votes by the Electoral College to cement Biden's victory. Yet there is still no sign that President Trump is willing to accept defeat. White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara reports.
Still no sign of concession from the White House, as Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany spoke to reporters Tuesday.
The president is still involved in ongoing litigation related to the election.
But earlier Tuesday, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, broke his long silence and congratulated President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris on their victory.
Our system of government has processes to determine who will be sworn in on January the 20th. The Electoral College has spoken.
On Monday, members of the Electoral College formally cemented Biden's victory with 306 electoral votes. Still, Trump continues to deny he lost.
Because this election was a fraud.
Earning a sharp rebuke from Biden, who on Monday night accused Trump of an unprecedented assault on democracy.
It's a position so extreme, we've never seen it before. A position that refused to respect the will of the people, refuse to respect the rule of law, and refuse to honor our Constitution.
Trump continues to promote baseless claims of voter fraud.
USA!
Claims that his supporters believe. They rallied in the nation's capital over the weekend.
This is not a banana republic. We need to fix the election.
A group of Republican House members say they will use Congress's tallying of the election results on January 6th to declare Trump the winner, a largely symbolic move. William Howell is a professor of American politics at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy.
It's less of a last-ditch attempt to actually turn the election around as it is just another opportunity for another performance wherein members of the Republican Party can demonstrate their, you know, fidelity to and commitment to Trump and Trumpism.
Trump and his allies have filed 60 lawsuits. All have failed to provide evidence of widespread fraud. William Howell is a professor of American politics at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy.
Every single state official responsible for elections, as far as even Attorney General William Barr, a close Trump ally, is concerned, there simply is no fraud.
Attorney General Barr, who has fallen out of favor with Trump after acknowledging the Justice Department he led found no widespread voter fraud, announced his resignation on Monday. Patsy Whitakaswara, VOA News.
What does McConnell's acknowledgement of Biden's victory mean for the U.S. Congress? And is the American election truly over? To find out, I reached out to VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Welcome to the show, Catherine. How's it going?
It's good. It's good.
Catherine, can you start out by explaining where prominent Republicans stand in terms of accepting Biden's election win?
So basically, once we heard from McConnell, we got a little bit of a shift in the way that most Republican senators were speaking about the election. Some really notable names like the Senate Majority Whip John Thune of South Dakota, Roy Blunt, John Cornyn, Tom Tillis, a big Trump ally in the Senate, Kevin Cramer of North Dakota. They're all now parsing this language, saying, look, the Electoral College has made their results, has announced their decisions, has certified the election. This is what is going to be happening. This is the direction we're moving in terms of a Biden presidency. And most notably, Chuck Grassley of the Senate Judiciary Committee has said the Constitution has answered the question of what has happened with the election. That's all you really need to know about what is happening on Capitol Hill. They're recognizing that they are in the last days of the Trump presidency here, and that they now need to be looking forward to a Biden presidency.
And so are there any holdouts that remain? Because there were, you know, 100 or so Republican members of the House of Representatives who had signed on to the Texas lawsuit trying to overturn the results of the election.
That's right. You know, I think most of the holdouts we're going to see are going to be over on the House side, the U.S. House of Representatives, which actually comes back into session today in Washington, D.C. I think those House Republicans who signed on to that letter are going to be getting a lot of questions moving forward about what they're going to be doing. You know, some of the more conservative members had said that they planned on challenging the House certifying the election results early next year. Mitch McConnell has been strongly encouraging Republican senators not to join on with that House challenge, to accept the results and move forward.
And what about President Trump?
So what's notable is that because Mitch McConnell recognized the results of the Electoral College, this really marks the first time that he's departed from President Trump in a significant way. And that certainly didn't escape the president's notice. He was tweeting overnight saying that Mitch McConnell and Republicans are not fighting hard enough for him. But really, this is a sign that he is really losing support among Republicans, that they are already looking past his presidency, and that this is a done deal, quite frankly.
Now, it may be a done deal for the White House, but it's not a done deal for Congress yet. There is a runoff election in the state of Georgia for two Senate seats. That vote finishes in early January. Early voting has already started. What are the stakes of this Georgia runoff for the U.S. Congress?
The stakes, quite frankly, couldn't be higher in Georgia because Democrats have to win both of those seats, unseating incumbent Republican senators, to get a tie in the U.S. Senate with then the tie-breaking majority vote in the form of the vice president-elect Kamala Harris. That is the only way that they are going to be able to get through any kind of big picture legislation in a Biden presidency. He was there in Georgia this week rallying for the Democratic candidates, saying that if he wants to get something done and hit the ground running in his presidency, he needs these two to win their elections.
That's VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
You too. Bye-bye.
President-elect Biden today plans to formally introduce his former rival Pete Buttigieg as his pick for U.S. Secretary of Transportation, adding to what is shaping up to be the most diverse cabinet in U.S. history. If confirmed by the Senate, the 38-year-old former South Bend, Indiana mayor would be the first openly gay cabinet secretary in U.S. history. For more on what this means for LGBTQ rights in the U.S., I reached out to Alfonso David, who is president of the Washington, D.C.-based Human Rights Campaign, which is a leading LGBTQ rights advocacy group in the U.S. Alfonso, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. No problem at all.
First off, what is your reaction to the news that America may have its first openly gay cabinet secretary?
This is breaking down a barrier that has existed forever. And my reaction was elation that we finally have an administration who recognizes the importance of diversity at all levels of government. We certainly have had administrations in the past that advance LGBTQ rights, but this is huge. To break down this barrier is significant.
And what does this mean for the gay rights movement in the U.S.?
Well, it means that identity should not be used as a tool to further oppress people. We know that in the past, being LGBTQ has been used as a shield to preclude people from being in certain positions, from serving in certain capacities. And that changes once again with Pete Buttigieg serving in a cabinet level position.
And if confirmed, Buttigieg will be the transportation secretary. I'm wondering, are there issues particularly related to transportation in the U.S. that really affect LGBTQ people in particular that he might be able to address?
Absolutely. What most people don't know is one out of five LGBTQ people in the United States live in poverty. They don't know that one out of five LGBTQ people have not been able to see a doctor because they cannot afford one. They may not know that more than 40% of LGBTQ people work in industries that were disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. Transportation is really essential to not only our economy, but making sure that the health and the welfare of our citizens can be advanced. And here, Pete Buttigieg, having the experience and the skill set and the intelligence to understand and appreciate how transportation affects the lives of everyday people, including LGBTQ people, will be a huge asset to the Biden administration.
You know, there's often this struggle for marginalized groups between one member of that group having power and then, on the other hand, reaching real equality or justice for the whole group. And I think former President Barack Obama is a great example of this. He was the first black president in America. But of course, there is not full equality and justice for black Americans in the U.S. So what do you think are the main struggles that remain for LGBTQ people in America today, despite this appointment?
Well, Pete Buttigieg's nomination is an historic moment for our community, but it does not end our advocacy. We have at least 41 transgender and gender nonconforming people who've been killed in the United States this year, more than any other year in recorded history. We have, unfortunately, LGBTQ people facing discrimination in housing and public accommodations and credit and education all over the country. Most recently, we had the Trump administration seeking to deny health care to LGBTQ people during a global pandemic. So we have a lot of work to do, from health care to education to public accommodations. We need to make sure that LGBTQ people are protected in all facets of life. And what we're going to be doing with the Biden administration is advancing a piece of legislation called the Equality Act. The Equality Act will provide comprehensive non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people under federal law. That does not exist today, and that's something that has to change.
That's Alfonso David, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Human Rights Campaign, which is a leading LGBTQ rights advocacy group in the U.S. Alfonso, thank you so much for joining us.
Jason, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
This is VOA. The terror trial of 14 people linked to the January 2015 Paris attacks on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and on a kosher supermarket ends today after 3 months. The trial took place amid fresh attacks in France over publication of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, and also amid a wave of coronavirus infections among the defendants. Three of the 14 accused fled to Syria just ahead of the attacks, which left 17 dead along with the three gunmen. They claimed the killings in the name of Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State group. The other 11 defendants, all men, claimed that any help that they may have given was either unwitting or for more run-of-the-mill crime like armed robbery. News organizations report German streets remained mostly empty on the first day of a new partial lockdown aimed at halting a surge in infections as the country reported a record number of COVID-19 deaths. The Robert Koch Institute, or RKI, reported Wednesday that 952 people died in the previous 24 hours, a figure that could rise as the hard-hit Saxony region was not included in Tuesday's numbers. The RKI said nearly 28,000 new coronavirus cases were registered, a figure close to the daily record of 30,000 infections reported on Friday in Germany. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. COVID-19 vaccines are being rolled out in numerous countries around the world, including the UK, US, Canada, China, Russia, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. But poorer countries are still waiting. An initiative known as COVAX, set up by the World Health Organization to give poorer nations access to COVID-19 vaccines, is short on cash, with only enough for a fraction of the 2 billion doses it hopes to buy over the next year. Some experts say the chances that coronavirus shots will be shared fairly between rich nations and the rest are fading fast, as most of the world faces a second wave of the pandemic. For more, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Kate Elder, who is a senior vaccines policy advisor for the group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, in New York.
While COVID-19 might be new, and this pandemic is new, the issues surrounding access to medicines and access to, you know, these vaccines that are now coming rapidly, those issues are not new. I mean, these are issues that we see time and time again that MSF sees in the medical field in terms of access to medicines, diagnostics, or vaccines, specifically what I work on, because of the way the current research and development and biomedical innovation system is set up, where we allow pharmaceutical companies to be the ones that really get to dictate who gets access to these medical tools, at what prices, and at what time frame. The COVAX facility has very important objectives. As Medicine Sans Frontières, we rely upon it because it needs to deliver vaccines for the populations that we care about and the populations we serve.
What are the options or alternatives open to either countries or citizens of these poorer countries?
I mean, in terms of options for them getting access to COVID-19 vaccines, I think the very sobering reality is that, sadly, they don't have many options. Their governments don't represent an attractive customer to pharmaceutical corporations that are looking to make money off of COVID-19 vaccines. The poorest countries of the world are not the countries that pharmaceutical corporations are running to try and engage in, you know, advance purchase arrangements with. So the people in these countries really, you know, the risk is that they're left behind. Again, a situation that we see just regularly in the work that MSF does and the work that we try to do to access medical tools for the populations that we serve. So, I mean, that's the risk in terms of people. In terms of, you know, what these governments can do, what we need is governments of developing countries to be using their voice to call foul on the way things are happening right now with access to COVID-19 vaccines. They need to speak up. They need to talk about these inequities. They need to talk about their concerns with the Gavi-led COVAX facility, that it might not be delivering vaccines to them anytime soon. They need to talk about, you know, what the world should be doing to put in check this power imbalance with pharmaceutical corporations having just so much power and seemingly the people having so little and truly being at the mercy of this system.
That was Kate Elder with Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, in New York, speaking to my colleague Chinedu Ofor. The world's largest COVID-19 outbreak remains in the U.S., with deaths over 300,000. Also hitting the country, hunger. Hunger Relief organization Feeding America says more people are seeking help at food banks nationwide as the pandemic worsens. More with VOA's Mariama Diallo.
Phyllis Marder quit her job as an Uber driver shortly after the coronavirus pandemic hit. Now she's struggling and says she's no longer embarrassed to go to food pantries to help her get by.
And then I decided that that was just like keeping a secret makes things get worse. So, and makes me feel worse about myself. And so I decided that it was more important to talk about it, like, you know, I have to pay my electric bill and I have to go to the food pantry.
There are many Americans like her. Feeding America, one of the largest anti-hunger organizations in the U.S., says the number of people seeking food assistance has increased an average of 60% since the pandemic began. Food banks and nonprofit groups are helping many survive. Brianna Dominguez, a mother of two, says she began going to pantries more often after her boyfriend lost his job. Her job will come to an end in about 2 weeks, and Dominguez hopes this Illinois food bank called Hillside Pantry will help them survive.
I'm pretty sure if I didn't have my job, I don't know what I would do. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have Hillside. It would be very hard.
New Orleans resident Norman Butler is unemployed and says he and family would go hungry without this food aid.
If it wasn't for the people being able to have you to come out to get some food to put on the table, we'd be worse off. No doubt, we would starve.
Butler says he isn't fortunate enough to be able to telework like so many Americans during the pandemic.
Because everybody can't work from home, and everybody doesn't have careers where they can just operate on a computer and still have their income coming in. Somebody like me, that's a limousine driver, shuttle bus driver, a bus boy.
And as he puts a block of cheese in his refrigerator.
This is what you call a blessing.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Facebook has shut down dozens of accounts and pages that it says were tied to France and Russia for spreading disinformation in African countries. It's the first time Facebook has accused French authorities of sowing misinformation. Both France and Russia are vying for influence in Africa, with France's military on the ground in the Sahel and Kremlin-linked Russian mercenaries accused of involvement in several countries. Facebook said the French misinformation campaign targeted the Central African Republic and Mali, and to a lesser extent Niger, Burkina Faso, Algeria, Cote d'Ivoire, and Chad. Facebook said the Russian operation mainly targeted Central African Republic, as well as Madagascar, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Mozambique, South Africa, and the Central African diaspora in France. The French army did not confirm involvement. The defense ministry told AFP that it wasn't surprised by Facebook's conclusions, but could not yet attribute responsibility. Russia has not commented on Facebook's latest findings. For more on this developing story, I reached out to journalist Catherine Field in Paris. Hi, Catherine. How are you today?
Good. What about you? How things with you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So first of all, can you explain, what did Facebook announce yesterday?
Facebook say they found what they described as a small-scale online disinformation campaign. They found three separate networks, one linked to French and two linked to Russian actors. Essentially, what it is this sort of geopolitical sparring on social media, a network of disinformation that was aimed particularly at people in the Central African Republic and Mali.
Now, Russian actors have been accused of sowing online disinformation for a long time now, but this is the first time that France has been accused. Who exactly in France was behind these accounts, according to Facebook?
According to Facebook, the allegation is that a group with links or associated with the French military were behind these networks. But this disinformation from the French side apparently started way back in May in 2018. It involved 84 Facebook accounts, 6 pages, 9 groups, and 14 Instagram accounts. And these accounts were all putting out what they described as fake news, or news that was vaguely fake or was very praising of the French role in the Sahel. These were posts that predominantly said how wonderful the French and the Malian armed forces were. It also was countering some of the posts on the Russian Facebook side. So there was always this back and forth. The French were sometimes said by the Russian trolls to be rapist thugs. The French Facebook groups were talking about Russian clandestine operations in Africa, very critical of Russian activities, particularly in the Central African Republic. One of the big things, though, about the French sites was they really didn't have that many followers. When you look at their pages in Mali, they had some 4,000 followers. Central African Republic, 34 followers. Compare that to the Russian sites where they had upwards of 200,000 followers.
Now, this comes at a time when France has troops on the ground in the Sahel region, and there's been some significant pushback with some large protests in Mali, for instance, against French military involvement in that country. But it also comes as French President Emmanuel Macron is really trying to portray France as a partner to African countries. He's pushed very hard to try to convince people that African countries want the French military to be in the Sahel, that they're there to help. But these allegations of France using misinformation seems to contradict that public approach by Macron.
I mean, these are going to be difficult questions for Emmanuel Macron to answer. It's going to be difficult questions for the military. Certainly, even though they might point to the fact that they only had 4,000 followers in Mali, the fact that somebody associated with the French military, you know, does raise questions. France does not have a clean, blank record when it comes to what it's done in French Africa, its zone of influence there over the last decades. It certainly will be interesting to see how it's received here in Paris and whether or not anyone else comes up with more information as to who is behind this.
That's journalist Catherine Fields in Paris. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, always a pleasure, Jason. You take care, huh?
That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.